and made what turned out to be one of Sydney's best movies. Stuff happens. Try not to react to any of it with blank horror. Panic is prohibited. Whatever it is, you have to take it in your stride, which you will be able to do because, of course, you're so thoroughly prepared. You have practiced and prepared several interpretations. You know your lines so well that adding in a couple more or fiddling about with one or two is child's play. Your mind is hanging loose enough to make the leap to where it needs to go. Staying focused. When you're on, and it's crucial you stay in the moment because the camera picks up everything. It's enormously important to maintain total concentration during your take, especially during a close-up. To listen and to react truthfully to find the real emotion, your brain will be working double time. If your attention strays, even for a moment, if you hesitate over your line for just a fraction of a second, if your eyes flicker because off-camera someone walks across your sightline, if you're thinking about what you're going to have for lunch, or the last shot, or the next shot, the camera will catch it. One of the times I found it most challenging to concentrate was when we were shooting Alfie. I had to run out into Notting Hill Gate, a busy street in West London. These days, Notting Hill is full of creative types, but this was pre-gentrification, and Notting Hill was a lot more earthy back then. My line was, "Darling, come back, I love you." And the people who had started to gather round to see what was going on in their neighbourhood evidently found this quite amusing. They started to heckle me, quite creatively. Maybe there were more creative types around there back then than I realised. The director told me to carry on and he would post-sync the sound in later. I just had to block it out and keep my focus. But most of the time, I don't have any difficulty concentrating. I've trained myself to be completely in the moment, isolated from whatever madness might be going on around me. It's hard to give instruction for how to do this, to articulate what is going on in my brain when I'm blocking out everything else, except that, like most things, it gets better with practice. In life, as in front of the camera, your audience will know when your attention strays, when you're only half concentrating on the meeting, when you're only three-quarters listening to your partner. In life, as in front of the camera, if you focus completely on what you're doing right now, you will stay truthful and have more impact. Relaxing and having fun. Don't forget that while you're achieving this intense focus and concentration, you also need to be achieving relaxation. It is this combination that will allow you to give your very best performance. I was not always a relaxed performer. I have already mentioned the bucket I used to have to keep in the wings when I first started performing on stage. Later, when I got my first tiny parts in movies, the deafening silence that followed the call of quiet on the movie set used to throw me in such a state of nervous collapse about my one line that, to my intense mortification, I often messed it up. Come to think of it, I was also extremely nervous on my first big movie. My first day shooting dialogue on location for Zulu was not designed to put me at my ease, and if I want to summon up a sense of memory of nervous exhaustion and near hysterical tension, I go back to that time. My heavy wool uniform was hot and uncomfortable under the intense South African sun. The upper-class British accent I had assured Cy Enfield would be no trouble at all was taking up half of my focus. The horse that had spent the previous day playing silly buggers was delighted to see me again and had thrown me in the river three times, each requiring a change of clothes. Staying on his back was taking the other half of my focus. Finally, I managed to walk the horse up to Stanley Baker and get out my line. "Hot day, hard work." "Cut," shouted Cy. "Why is your voice so high?" I protested that this was just my normal voice, like I'd used in rehearsal. So he had the sound technician play it back. Then I heard it. I was so nervous that my shoulders had tensed and my throat had tightened, and as a result I had transformed myself from an effete but convincing tenor to a shrieking soprano. The horse and I had to cross that river one more time. I had to force myself to relax, which, as anyone who has ever been urged to just relax would tell you, is extremely difficult. And finally, I nailed the line. Now I'm always relaxed on set, so much so that occasionally I even fall asleep. Alan Arkin likes to tell the story of being on set and walking past me dozing off like a pensioner on a deck chair. It must have been a slight worry for the director, Zach Braff, seeing one of his stars comatose. Or maybe he didn't spot me, because what Alan also says is the next thing Zach yelled, "Action," and off I went like a bomb. There was no transition. He went from snoring to be 120% ready. I just couldn't believe it. It was like a thoroughbred at the starting gate. I don't know about thoroughbreds. Some might say I'm not far off the knacker's yard, but I still know my way around the racetrack. In general, I would say relax, but don't get so relaxed you fall asleep. If you're asleep on the job, you can't expect the audience to stay awake. Some actors work out tension rather than relaxation. It's okay for them, I guess, but it does put a strain on everyone around them. They get everyone wound up and upset and then ready to go. I'm the opposite. I'm laughing and cracking jokes until the very last minute, even if in the scene I'm going to cry. Then I finish the scene and I'm back to cracking jokes. My top tip for dealing with nerves? Preparation, of course. Experience helps, too. Knowing you've done it before, tackled difficult things in the past and got through them, gives you confidence that you can do it again. The importance of experience was brought home to me recently when I was asked to do a poetry reading in Westminster Abbey. Even thinking about it brought me out in hives. I was back in my old stage fright and the bucket in the wings. It wasn't the grandeur of the building or the occasion. It was a lack of experience. I had barely ever read a poem and certainly had never recited one in public. I said, "Thank you very much for asking, but I'd rather not have a nervous breakdown in Westminster Abbey." I usually do relaxation exercises before difficult scenes as well. Take a deep breath in, then bend over with your arms dangling loose and your legs a little bit bent and enjoy the blood rushing to your head. Straighten up slowly while you breathe out. Take three more deep breaths. You'll feel more relaxed, more focused, and more in control. The only time I wouldn't do this is if I'm supposed to be nervous in the scene. Then I skip the relaxation exercise and have a double espresso instead. When I was in Sleuth with Laurence Olivier, the most difficult scene was the one when my character thinks that Larry's character is going to kill him and begs for mercy beside himself with terror. I had starred in a lot of films by this time, but playing opposite Laurence Olivier was somewhat nerve-wracking, so I was actually more nervous than usual, and I deliberately, for this scene, did not try to calm my nerves. My disintegration into a jabbering mess begging for my life was pretty convincing, including to me, and evidently to Lord Olivier. As we walked back to the dressing room, Larry came up and put his arm around me. "When we started this film," he said, confidentially, "I thought of you as a talented assistant." He left a dramatic pause, a la Olivier. "But now I see that I have a partner." I don't think I've ever received a compliment that has meant more to me. I only once resorted to alcohol to deal with nerves, and it was a special case. I was doing Death Trap, the 1982 sleuth-like thriller, in which I played opposite Christopher Reeve as his lover, and the two of us plotted together to kill my wife. There was a scene in which we had to kiss each other, passionately, and never having kissed a man before, except my dad, on his cheek, I was finding it hard to psych myself up to it. I tried convincing myself it was an honour to kiss Superman. I was nervous as hell. In the end, we got through it, though. Not with breathing exercises, but with a bottle of brandy between us. We nailed the kiss, but we were both so drunk we couldn't remember our lines. I do like the laugh. I remember Roger Moore, years ago, saying to me, "Cheer up, you'd better have a good time because this is not a rehearsal. This is life. This is the show." Taking work seriously doesn't mean that you can't have any fun. Quite the opposite. I usually find things go better when everyone's having a good time. Some actors are always worrying, always complaining. They're what I call losing the light actors. For them, it isn't perfect. It's all spoiled. It's a bad script or a good script, but the director doesn't know how to treat it. Or the script is okay and the director's great, but the other actors have all been miscast. And incidentally, the lighting is all wrong and they don't have enough lines. I come from another school of thought. In this school, we have more fun and we get more done. We're invigorated and entertained by the challenge that each day brings. We take pleasure in either moving the inevitable stumbling blocks out of the way or finding a way to dodge around them. We feel so privileged to be part of the game that we keep playing long after all the light has gone and it's time for bed. Doing serious work doesn't mean you can't have any fun either. Making a comedy can turn into a grueling slog if you get actors and crew with the wrong attitudes, but by the same token, with the right people, making a serious piece can be a scream. Anthony Hopkins told me that he had never had more laughs on a set than when he was making the terrifying horror film The Silence of the Lambs with Jodie Foster. It's hard for me to narrow down which movies I've had the most fun making. The Man Who Would Be King was wonderful fun because Sean Connery and I had such good on-screen chemistry, and John Huston gave us the freedom to run with it. The atmosphere on set was very special. However, the chronic diarrhea I suffered through the shoot in Morocco did reduce the spring in my step a little. I had a party making Bullseye with Roger Moore and Michael Winner, but a terrible hangover when the movie came out and flopped. A very strong contender would have to be Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, shot in my dream location within close reach of many excellent restaurants and beaches. There was one scene with Glenn Headley, a terrific actress who sadly died at just 62, that we had to shoot 50 times. We just couldn't stop laughing. It's also important to be able to laugh at yourself. Take your work seriously, yes, but don't, whatever you do, get all pompous and start taking yourself too seriously. It's fortunate that this has never been a problem for me. Peter Sellers started taking the mickey with the "not many people know that line." He was obsessed with gadgets, and he had one of the first answering machines. I phoned him one day, and his message was an impersonation of me saying, "This is Michael Caine speaking. Peter Sellers is out. Not many people know that." Little sod. Then, in about 1972, he did it on Parkinson, which was the most popular chat show at the time. I got in on the joke myself in Educating Rita, where my character said the line kind of as an in-joke. Not many people know that. It was also me going, "My name is Michael Caine," on the 1984 Madness track. "My name is Michael Caine." My daughter, Natasha, who was 11 years old at the time, really liked Madness, and she persuaded me to do it. Paul Whitehouse did a rip-off of me as Harry Palmer in Harry Enfield's television program, going, "My name is Michael Payne, and I'm a nosy neighbor." And now Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan have revived it all again in The Trip, when they bicker with each other about who can do the best Michael Caine impressions. I think it's bloody hilarious, although the best Michael Caine impression I've heard is Tom Hanks. He did it on Saturday Night Live. I was surprised because I know Tom Hanks, and unlike everyone else I ever met, he'd never done that impression for me. Luckily, I don't ever get tired of people quoting myself at me, so long as it doesn't make me sound too much like a moron. In fact, these days, I quote myself back again. I can do an excellent Michael Caine impression. "My name is Michael Caine." See? Can you ever have too much fun at work? I can think of a couple of ways. If you're laughing so much you can't get any work done, in acting we call it corpsing, the director is going to shut the party down pretty quickly. And you don't want to have too much of the wrong kind of fun with your leading lady or any other cast member. Movies are notoriously bad for marriages. First of all, you're away from each other for long stretches. There's a saying in the movies, location doesn't count. But look at the movie divorce rate and you will see that this rule does not always apply. I mean, you go away on location for 3 months, maybe somewhere exciting and glamorous, and your partner stays at home. And when you get back, you've had a great time and made a load of new friends, and she's had a great time and made a load of new friends, and you're kind of strangers. That puts a strain on a marriage. Then in the movies, you're often being paid to kiss and cuddle your fabulous new friends, or even to get into bed and pretend to make love to them. This is where you have to abandon method acting and keep things extremely professional. It will save your marriage, and it will save the movie. The point goes more widely, of course, in any other walk of life. Don't confuse having fun with being unprofessional or disrespectful of your colleagues, and don't act in a way that might allow your professional reputation to be undermined by unwelcome gossip. My long marriage to Shakira has survived for two reasons. First, I married the most beautiful, intelligent, kind, and all-round wonderful person in the world. And second, Shakira always came with me on location. Not so much to keep an eye on me or for me to keep an eye on her, but so that our lives would stay intertwined. There is a myth that film stars are all demanding divas. If that was ever true, it isn't now. There are too many talented people around for anyone to be prepared to put up with that kind of nonsense for long. All things being equal, film people prefer the actor who turns up on time, knows his lines, is fun to work with and stays focused on the task in hand. In life, as in movies, competence is a basic and yet all too rare quality. Never underestimate its value. Most people will pick competent professionalism over erratic brilliance any day of the week. Chapter 9. Taking Direction. Movie actors are expected to fully prepare their roles before they arrive on set, and then to simply get on with it without needing constant streams of praise and feedback. The director is thinking about the many technical and aesthetic aspects of the movie, not just about the actor's performance. So if he says nothing, we can assume he's happy. But we also need to be able to take direction, to listen, to be flexible, to respond in the moment, to take criticism on board. As in movies, so in life, we all have to work things out for ourselves and take responsibility for whatever is down to us. But at the same time, you have to be open to what the governor has to say, whether that means the boss, the client, or your partner in life. I have worked with at least 100 directors in my 7 decades in the movies, including some of the very best in the business. I have learned to start out from the position of trusting that the director knows what he's doing. It might not always be obvious to me why he seems to be letting another actor get away with terribly bad acting, or why he has called go again for yet another take when I said my line perfectly, or why he wants me to try it a different way. But that's because I can't see the big picture. I can only see it from my limited point of view. The director might be looking for something I haven't thought about. He might have seen something I haven't, or he might be intending to edit things in a way that wouldn't occur to me. All directors want what is best for the whole picture, and most of them know how to achieve it, so I try to take whatever's thrown at me and go with it. Whether your director or your boss is good, bad, or ugly, for the time you are stuck with them, you have to do your best to make it work. And whether good, bad, or ugly, I have learned something from every director I have worked with. In fact, although it's much more difficult to do a good job under a bad director, it can be a very valuable experience. I think of it as the actor's equivalent of an athlete training at altitude and running on sand. It's bloody hard work, and you're not going to achieve a personal best. But it means that when you get to work with a good director or run on a hard track, you're able to perform even better than before. My favorite directors to work with are so sparing in their direction and reassuring about their grip. Joe Mankiewicz, who directed Sleuth, was a master at reassurance. I really needed it on that movie because I was intimidated to be working with Laurence Olivier, who was an iconic actor and an incorrigible upstager and scene stealer. An upstager is someone who keeps moving backwards upstage, so forces the other actor to turn their heads away from the camera in order to say their lines to him. A scene stealer is someone who puts on a little raised eyebrow or a twitchy nose, drawing focus to them at your key moment. You see it in life, everywhere. Olivier was also an Oscar-winning director, so I wondered how Joe was feeling. On my first day before the great Lord Olivier had arrived, Joe watched me walking myself quietly around the set. I must have been exuding unease because he let me finish, then he came over and he put his arm round my shoulder. "Don't worry, Michael," he said. "I'll take care of you." It was just what I needed to hear. A few days later, I was concerned again, though. Larry was a force of nature who conducted himself at all times at the very highest level in intensity, and he wanted to be front and center in every scene. Larry would position himself where he wanted to be, and I was expected to act around him. Whenever a line of mine interfered with a move of his, he would order Joe to cut it. Eventually, I went to Joe to complain. "Don't worry, Michael," he said again. I said, "I'd take care of you, and I will. Every time I promise to cut a line, I promise to cut it in the editing. Did you notice? And the next time Larry turns you around, turn right around, and I'll put a second camera over his shoulder for a close-up on you. We have skilled camera operators and an editing suite. It will all be taken care of. Trust me." I did, and it was. I twice had the tremendous experience of being directed by the man I regarded as the greatest all-round movie talent of our time, the late, great John Huston. 15 times Academy nominee, director of my childhood heroes, director of three of my all-time favorite childhood movies, The African Queen, The Treasure of Sierra Madre, and The Maltese Falcon. John first cast me in The Man Who Would Be King, in the part of Peachy Carnahan, that he had originally written 20 years earlier for my idol, Humphrey Bogart. We worked together a second time in Escape to Victory in 1981. John was something of a father figure to me. He was very gentle with actors, because he loved being one himself, and he had an aura about him, charisma maybe, or star quality, that seemed effortlessly to command attention and respect. It was John who taught me not to expect constant input from a director, and that the quality of a director's input could not always be measured by the number of times he interacted with me or the number of words he threw in my direction. When we were working together on The Man Who Would Be King in 1975, something started to bother me, and after a few days I brought it up. "John," I said, "you never give me any direction." "Michael," said John, in that laconic Wild West voice of his, like gravel or like God, "you get paid a great deal of money to do this. You don't need me to tell you what to do." He was right. After that, a director moving on to his next show was all the indication I needed that he was happy with my performance. In the end, though, he did give me a direction, with the minimum of words and fuss. A day or two later, he anchored my character for me in just a few words. I was in the middle of a long speech, and I thought I was going very well, when suddenly John shouted, "Cut!" He looked at me and smiled a slow smile. "You could speak faster, Michael. He's an honest man." His point, which was dead right, was that honest men don't need to take the time to think about their words or study the impact they're making. They just talk. Lewis Gilbert directed me in Alfie in 1966, for which I got my first Academy Award nomination, and in Educating Rita in 1983, for which I earned another. So he holds a special place in my heart. He came from a similar background to me and was an understated, sincere man with feeling for actors. Like John Huston, he believed in letting actors get on with it unless he spotted some fatal flaw in their performance, at which point he would put you back on track with just a few words. I found him a joy to work with. It was Lewis who made the to-camera pieces of Alfie work so well. Our first instinct had been to treat them like asides in the theatre, where an actor steps away from the main action to address the audience. I spoke my lines into the camera as though I was making a long declamatory speech to a packed auditorium, basing my performance on Laurence Olivier and Richard III, and Albert Finney in Tom Jones. "Cut," Lewis said, "it's not working. We need something more intimate, more current." He moved the camera in and asked me to try it again, but this time as though I was speaking to just one close confidant. It was an unusual idea, but I knew exactly who I was going to be speaking to. My friend Jim. Jim would have entirely appreciated Alfie's tastier remarks, and imagining him on the other side of the camera gave me the air of cheeky charm and supreme confidence that I needed to deliver them. That delivery somehow got the cinema audience rooting for Alfie, even if they didn't entirely approve of all his immoral antics. Brian De Palma was quite shy and reserved, perhaps even a little cold. By the way of illustration, I did one scene for him where I wound up having hysterics in a heap on the floor. We were shooting, and I was there on my own, breaking down and crying, giving it my all. Eventually, Brian said, "Cut!" Walked over to me, lying on the floor, put his hand down, helped me up, and said, "Great." "Huh?" said the cameraman. "He really must like you. I've never seen him that emotional before." Brian was chilly, and the movie, Dress to Kill, was a bit dark for my taste, but I enjoyed the challenge of working with such an exciting director, an incredibly skilled technician. Brian would just keep shooting until he got exactly what he wanted. One shot involved a 360-degree swing of the camera and took 26 takes, 25 more than I usually like. Mike Myers, by contrast, was warm, crazy, and determined that he and everyone else should have fun. In Austin Powers in Goldmember, I played Nigel Powers, Austin's father. It was essentially a send-up of the 60s Man About Town, a send-up of me, or at least my image from the time, and I loved every moment. Mike, who was starring and directing, is as wacky in real life as he seems in his movies, and liked to play rock and roll between takes. At first, I didn't take to having this music blasting out when I was trying to remember my lines, but I got used to it, and then I started looking forward to it. A couple of times, we even had a little dance. Mike loves what he does, and he makes sure everyone else has a blast too. The director for whom I've made the most movies, and perhaps the director with whom I've felt most comfortable in my entire career, is Christopher Nolan, a brilliant London-born writer-director whom I consider to be the David Lean of his generation. I have had the enormous privilege of appearing in 7 of Chris's movies, his 3 blockbuster Batman movies, his 3 super-clever mind-bender movies, The Prestige, Interstellar, and Inception, and most recently the terrific Dunkirk. Chris calls me his lucky charm. When there was no part for me in Dunkirk, he cast me as the voice of the squadron leader who talks to the pilots over their radio to make sure I was there in the credits. I feel that it's more the other way around. He is my lucky charm. Christopher Nolan is a fabulously clever writer and director, and some of his movies that I've acted in I still don't fully understand. Chris did reveal to me that the only bits of Inception that are real, as opposed to the dreams or imagination, are the bits I'm in. Still, when people ask me what's it about, I just say it's about 2 hours. In his directorial style, he reminds me very much of that other great writer-director, John Huston. Like John, he is sparing and softly spoken, but he's always on the nose with his direction. If he needs you to alter something, he won't shout cut. He will let you go through the whole take, then wander over and tell you in a very gentle and understated way, after a sip of tea, he keeps going all times. Can we do another one, Michael? At this time, could you do it this way? It's all very calm. There's never a raised voice. He's quiet authority. To be honest, if you walked onto the set, you wouldn't even know who the director was, because he's just wandering around. No ego. Very quiet. And like John, he can be this way because he has put the effort in up front. He has a crystal clear vision, terrific scripts with real characters, a great producer, Emma Thomas, who also happens to be his wife, and he casts like a dream. I remember I once asked John what the art of direction was. Casting, he replied. If you cast it right, you don't have to tell the actors what to do. Chris Nolan is the same. I don't want to sound conceited, but his casting is wonderful. I remember, for example, the first scene I made on my first Chris Nolan movie, Batman Begins, in 2005. It was with Christian Bale, the best Batman ever, in my view. Great casting. And after just the second take, Chris said, cut, print, and we were off. Chris brought Christian Bale and me together again the following year for Prestige, a story about magicians, violence, and love. This time joined by Hugh Jackman, who is one of my favorite actors and people. Hugh can do anything, sing, dance, act in the cinema and the theater, and he's terrific to work with, too. To top it all, I was working with 2 brilliant and beautiful actresses, Scarlett Johansson and Rebecca Hall, and with David Bowie like you've never seen him before. Very straight-laced and severe, looking like a middle-aged banker in a suit and tie and a moustache. In 2010, Chris pulled together another stunning cast for Inception. Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Hardy, Ellen Page, Cillian Murphy, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Marion Cotillard, and Ken Watanabe. And in 2014, he did it again with Interstellar, whose cast included Jessica Chastain, Anne Hathaway, Ellen Burstyn, Matthew McConaughey, and Casey Affleck. Between the 6 of us, we had 6 Academy Awards and 20 nominations. And I'm sure more to come. And Chris not only casts wonderful actors, he also recasts them. I'm not the only one he has used again and again in his movies. In fact, he has almost created his own little repertory company. My point is that, in my experience, the best directors, like the best leaders in other industries, achieve great things by gathering the right people around them and then trust them to get on with what they do best, giving them a quiet nudge whenever they need it to keep them on track. The approach tends to make everyone, actors and crew, do their best work, happy, productive, and tremendously loyal. Bad directors are bad for all the same reasons other bosses are bad. They are not good enough for their jobs, they don't work hard enough, or they are bullies. Of course, it's more fun to learn from good directors, but even the bad ones have things to teach you, like self-protection, self-reliance, which are part of being a true professional. And in the very worst cases, they might force you to learn how to direct yourself. There was one movie I worked on where it quickly became clear to the entire cast that the director was off with the fairies, probably tapping them up for the fairy dust he seemed to have developed a taste for. We realised we'd have to deliver the picture ourselves. We did, and the director in question was deemed to have done a fabulous job. The boss takes credit for other people's work in all walks of life. On another occasion, a movie with a stellar cast working at the top of their game was ruined by an illustrious veteran director who one day openly admitted to me that he was only still directing to fund his very expensive hobby of deep-sea fishing off the coast of California. As soon as the filming was done and he had been paid, off he went. He was at sea, and sadly so were editing and post-production without him. The hardest directors to work with, and unfortunately you find them in every workplace, every family, every community of people, are the bullies. My approach with bullies has always been to make it clear from the start that I won't be their victim. When I worked with Otto Preminger on Harry Sundown in 1966, I knew his reputation as a monstrous tyrant who was happiest when everyone else was miserable. I had heard that he liked to scream at actors and crew alike. So the first time I met him, I told him, "You need to know, Otto, that I am very sensitive. You mustn't shout at me. If anyone shouts at me when I'm working, I burst into tears and I can't work for the rest of the day." Otto stared back at me. He seemed genuinely puzzled, or perhaps I thought he was getting ready for a particularly big scream. "But why would you think I would do that?" he finally asked. "Well," I said, I stayed calm. "I have friends who worked with you on St. Joan, and they said you shouted." "You shouldn't make such friends," said Otto. "I only shout at bad actors, and I would never shout at Alfie." Whether because he considered me a good actor, because he loved Alfie, or more likely because I had made things clear at the start, Otto never shouted at me. He did, though, give everyone else a terrible time, especially my young co-star, Faye Dunaway. My little talk hadn't managed to change his personality, only to protect me personally from it. Otto tormented the inexperienced and sweet Faye, who ended up in tears most days. Of course, everyone worked in a state of abject terror, which was not only deeply unpleasant, but also did nothing for the quality of the movie, since no one can give their best when they are rigid with fear or doing something wrong and being screamed at. And Faye ended up paying a lot of money to get out of her 6-movie contract with Otto, going on to become an enormous star. Disagreeing with a good director is very different from having to work with a bad one. I adopt a couple of approaches in this situation. If I am convinced that the direction I want to take with a particular scene is the right one, I may suggest a compromise. I may propose we try it his way, and then we try it my way, and then he can decide when he sees the rushes. The director usually agrees and usually turns out to be right. I've got my point of view, but he has the vision, seeing the bigger picture. But at least this way, I get the chance to see I'm wrong. Then again, sometimes I just tell the director he's right, then go my own way anyway. What I never do is have a stand-up row about it. Part of the skill of taking direction is knowing who to listen to and when, and who to ignore. Unfortunately, an awful lot of advice is not worth hearing. People will give you advice at the drop of a hat. People who don't really know you. People who don't really know what they're talking about. People who are really giving themselves advice, not addressing you or your problems. Not to mention the critics. The best and most thoughtful critics will sometimes say something helpful, but so many of them are so wrong so much of the time that on the whole, I would advise taking criticism from your trusted circle and from yourself. I am my own most severe critic, and ignoring the rest. Most of the advice I received in the first 30 years of my life can be very quickly summarized. Give up. So I formed a habit of ignoring any advice that came my way and followed my own path. That worked out fine as it happens, but I've changed that habit now. Now I would recommend searching out a small group of people, Mine is made up mainly of agents, close friends, my wife, and, of course, a very good accountant, who know you well, who know what you want, who have your interests at heart, and who know more than you do. Listen to them. Look to them for advice and direction. Tune out everyone else, especially the critics. A good agent will guide, protect, advocate, and champion. Most of us have these people in our lives, even if we don't give them the professional title of agent and 10% of our earnings. Choose your agent well. They can have a profound impact on your career. My first, Jimmy Fraser, had impressive offices in Regent Street. I was too small a fish for him. He never seemed hugely keen on me, and he dropped me as soon as he saw the finished film, A Hill in Korea, telling me that I would never get anywhere. Sound familiar? Mind you, Jimmy did get me that film in the first place, so I have to thank him for that. And he was right. I was terrible in it. My next was the wonderful and dogged Josephine Burton. Josephine was one of the first professionals who ever believed in me. But she struggled to find me work. This was the era of Joan Littlewood and endless small TV and theatre roles. When she died unexpectedly and much too young during a routine operation, it was an immense personal and professional blow. It was another couple of years before I struck agent gold. I had written to Dennis Selinger, the top actor's agent in the UK, asking him to take me on, but he had declined. Then in 1961, he saw me in the compartment and changed his mind. It was a key moment in my career. Dennis was the perfect agent. He had wonderful contacts and wonderful judgment. He was kind and gentle, not a shouter and screamer. He was very commercial, but he was not greedy. And he was savvy and far-sighted enough to know that at that point, I needed critical as well as commercial success. I had to appear in the right shows and come to the attention of influential people, not just to do whatever would make the most money. Later, when I made my first real money, £4,000 on Zulu, and promptly burned my way straight through it, it was Dennis who persuaded me to open a bank account, which consisted of £1,000 overdraft, and get an accountant. It was Dennis who flew out to Las Vegas to give Shakira away when we got married in 1973. The night my daughter Natasha was born, I went straight from the hospital to Dennis's house to tell him the good news. Over the following 2 weeks, when she became dangerously ill, I stayed with Dennis, who was a tower of strength. He became my closest friend and most valued mentor. He died in 1998, and I miss him still. Dennis was UK-based, and when I arrived in Hollywood, I needed a local guide. I was immensely fortunate to end up as the least-known client of the fierce and fiercely loyal Sue Menkes, Hollywood's most powerful agent at the time. Sue held extraordinary and much sought-after get-togethers in Hollywood. It was usually meatloaf on the menu, and she always instructed us to be out of her house by 10:30. The fun was seeing who else would be there, because Sue cast her dinners like she would cast a movie. The night we turned up and found Barbara Streisand, Sting, and Sheryl Crow around the table was not unusual. Another memorable night featured Princess Margaret, Jack Nicholson, Clint Eastwood, and by special request, Barry Manilow. Sue loved her food almost as much as she loved her clients, and after her death, Bette Midler starred in a one-woman show about her called I'll Eat You Last, A Chat with Sue Menkes. When I went to see it, I enjoyed every moment but one. At that point, Midler answers the phone, sighs, turns to the audience, and puts the phone down again. She says, Michael Caine has just left me. An audience of 600 people turned and looked at me with utter malice. It's true, I did leave Sue once. I can't remember why. Anyway, I soon realized my mistake, because my new agent got me a role in Steven Seagal's On Deadly Ground, shooting in Alaska. I made it up with Sue and went back to her. Dennis was irreplaceable, and Sue was a unique human being, but I landed on my feet again. When she retired, Sue Menkes strongly approved of my move to the passionate, driven, and determined Tony Howard, another giant of the Hollywood scene. Tony has believed in me, loved me, and protected me for well over 20 years now. Since 1994, she has guided my career beautifully, and she is now the one person I listen to when I'm making big decisions. She's a dear friend, too, almost family, in fact. Shakira and I think of Tony and her husband David, her sister Wendy, and Wendy's husband Leonard, as our Hollywood family. Meanwhile, my agents in England for the last few years, the wonderful Kate Buckley Sharma, have found me amazing British projects that I was able to do without leaving home. An actor also needs a talented and loyal press agent, a ruthless lawyer, and a wise business manager. I have been fortunate enough to have all of these. Like a director whose secret ingredient is casting, I sometimes think my secret ingredient is the people I choose to put around me. I couldn't end this chapter without mentioning the friends who have stayed with me through thick and thin, and offering great advice at just the right moment. Shakira and I have a wonderful supportive group of friends from within the industry and outside it. Friends to have dinner with, and friends like Doris Musayev, married to the former president of Iceland, Ólafur Grímsson, and Natasha's godmother, who we know we could call in the middle of the night and she would be there for us. But if I could pick out just one, then the one friend whose advice changed the course of my life was Jack Nicholson. Not everyone's idea of a fairy godmother, I grant you, but for me, Jack will always be holding a magic wand and wearing a tiara. He persuaded me to come out of my first retirement, and in Blood and Wine he also gave me the vehicle to do it with. It was a turning point in my career when I was downed and almost out. But that's for another chapter. Chapter 10, The Big Picture. The award ceremony speech in which the big star thanks a great long list of people without whom none of this would have been possible is by now a cliché. But making a movie really is a tremendous team effort. The makeup artists, the set designers, the caterers, the sound engineers, the lighting technicians, the camera operators, the producers. The list goes on and on. Everyone has a role to play. Everyone is as much of an expert in what they do as you are in what you do. No one is more important than anyone else, and everyone is focused on the same thing, making the best movie possible. In every movie, I think of the whole team as my temporary family and my route to success, so I don't ever put myself above anyone else, and I don't put myself in competition with the other actors. Instead, I try to understand what other people in the team can do for me and what I can do for them to help everyone to make a better movie. And it's not just movies. It was the same for me in the restaurant business, and I bet it's the same in any other enterprise. I might have been the owner, but it takes the whole team, every chef, every waiter, every cleaner and washer-upper, doing their jobs and doing their best to send the customers away happy at the end of their dinners. Don't put yourself above anyone else. When you're referred to as the talent and when you arrive on set in a chauffeur-driven limousine, only to become the prime focus of a swarm of charming hair and makeup artists, and when electricians are scrambling up on scaffolding to reset the light so there is a lovely glint in your eyes, it's easy to start to believe the hype. Don't. Yes, everyone is trying their best to make you feel happy and relax. Yes, everyone is focused on helping you to look and sound your best. But that is not because you are more important than they are. It is because they want to get the best performance possible out of you for the good of the team. Try to remember that the runner holding an umbrella when you take a walk in the rain is there for the costume, not for you. I try to establish friendly and relaxed relations with everyone from the moment I walk onto the set. It's the right thing to do, and it makes everything go better for the movie and for me. If the crew are feeling fabulous, they will do their jobs better. If you are good to everyone on the unit, chances are they will be good to you. Anyway, if you try to work out who is important and who is not and treat them accordingly, you'll be caught out by your own prejudices. John Huston was a strapping great man's man, and his writing partner was a little old lady called Gladys Hill. She looked like a secretary, but she was actually very influential. It would have been easy to overlook her, but it would have been wrong. I find it easier just to treat everyone just the same, at least until they give me reason to do otherwise. To understand what other members of the team can do for me and what I can do to make their lives easier, it helps if I understand the whole process of filmmaking, not just my little part of it, the commercial process and the creative process, the financial and the technical. In any walk of life, it will usually be worthwhile to take the time to understand where others are coming from and what their priorities and requirements are. Understanding the process, I found, can be much more important than understanding the piece itself. I can't tell you how many plays and movies I've appeared in that I didn't fully understand. From RUR, the obscure Carol Capek play in which a 14-year-old me made his debut as a robot, to Chris Nolan's Inception and Interstellar, via everything by Harold Pinter, I appeared in his first play, The Room, and his last work, a remake of Sleuth. But I always keep in mind, as a basic commercial consideration, that anything an actor does that introduces delay is going to cost the production time and money, and probably you, your next job. So as you probably know by now, prepare yourself well and turn up on time are my first rules in life. It is also crucially important that actors understand the technical requirements of the camera operators, the sound engineers, the lighting technicians, the continuity folk, and so on, so that they can prepare their own contribution with those in mind. For example, it's no good thinking up some complicated physical mannerism if you're not going to be able to repeat it exactly shot after shot, possibly over several days. In movie making, you will usually need to repeat any sequence at least 3 times, once for the long shot or master shot, once for the medium shot, and once for the close-up. If you fiddle around in the long shot, you will have to be able to repeat that fiddle exactly in every shot, or the long shot will have to be shot again. For the sake of the continuity folk, I keep my mannerisms and actions simple, precise, planned, logical, so that I can execute them effortlessly and accurately again and again and again. You can think of the continuity folks as terrible fusspots, or as I prefer to, as your indispensable best friend on set. You can't do the second take without them. Camera operators are less fussy. You'd be surprised by the places I've seen cameras put when really necessary. It's useful to know this. It means that when I'm rehearsing, I'll move to wherever seems right for me and wait to be told if it's going to cause a problem. Of course, sometimes the director says, "I don't want a discussion about it. You need to end up exactly there." And then I do. There are also various things you could do to help the camera operator help you. If the director tells me to run from right over there towards the camera and then pass it, I run like hell when I'm far away and then slow down as I approach the camera. Otherwise, I go by too fast and I'm just a blur. I learned that from James Cagney. And if I'm sitting down for a close-up and have to stand, I do that slowly too, and on cue to give the camera the chance to follow me in close-up. Any sudden movement, and I'm out of the frame. Sound technicians are never happy, so their unhappiness can to some extent be discounted. However, if you want to avoid a boom being accidentally dropped on your head, make sure the sound technician knows in advance when you're planning on switching from a whisper to a roar. In one of the many features in which I played some kind of gangster in the early stages of my career, I was supposed to creep up to a guy, whisper, "Time's up," and shoot him in the back. The sound technician, listening through his big headphones, had his equipment turned up to full volume so that he could hear the whisper, and was all set to turn it back down for the shot. I did my walk, then forgot to say the line and just fired the shot. The sound engineer took the rest of the day off. Since we actors very much want to stay alive, I also make a point of understanding a little bit about the world of the stunt artists. So I'm not afraid to draw the line. Sometimes we all have to be our own health and safety officer. If you look at it from other people's point of view, it will become clear why you should never do a dangerous stunt on the last day of a picture. The change in attitude to your personal well-being is a bit like the change you encounter from a salesperson before and after you sign that piece of paper, or from a company that's been trying to woo you before and after you accept their job offer. I learned this from Stanley Baker, the producer of Zulu. It was not the last day of the movie, but the second. But a similar principle applied. You may remember from an earlier chapter that on those first days of shooting, my horse and I did not see eye to eye, and I spent a great deal of time on the ground or in the water, in the various undignified positions into which my horse had thrown me. I was a bit aggrieved that no one seemed bothered about my back at the end of the first day's filming, or my knees at the end of the second. Everyone seemed concerned about the horse, the sun, even my costume. Was it ripped? Was it dirty? But not a word about whether I was okay. I brought it up with Stanley Baker, and he explained with a grin simple, he said. You've only done two scenes, and at this point we could easily replace you. Probably more cheaply than we could replace the horse. I opened my mouth to protest, but he went on, the more shots you're in, the more careful we will be about you. Towards the end, you will become extremely precious to us, and we will overwhelm you with fuss, care, and attention. Until the final scene, when once again, we won't give a shit. Golden rule, Michael. Never do a dangerous stunt on the last day of a picture. And I never have. In fact, I prefer to leave the stunts to the stunt artists. I don't want to do them out of a job, do I? And I don't want to do myself out of a limb. Billion Dollar Brain, my third Harry Palmer movie, was shot on location in Finland, a beautiful and inconceivably cold country, where we spent days filming on the melting ice floes, hoping that they wouldn't crack, and meanwhile standing in 3 inches of melting ice water. At one point, the director, Ken Russell, was asking me to jump into a hole in the ice. It's the kind of thing Harry might do, but it wasn't the kind of thing I much fancied doing. I had a Finnish stand-in, though, and I thought, he probably wouldn't mind. I wandered up to him. I said, how would you like to earn a bit of extra money? Could you just warm up in the sauna and then jump into that hole in the ice? He gave me a long look. What? You know, jump in the ice like Finnish people do. No, we don't, he said. We would have heart attacks. Neither of us jumped in the ice. Stunt artists save our lives, literally. Editors do it metaphorically. Skilled editing can make an enormous difference to a performance, finessing poor timing and removing awkward movements. A cut to a great reaction shot can make a bungled line seem much stronger than it actually was. But of course, an editor can also cut you out entirely and kill your performance completely. Sometimes an editor will kill your darling or edit out your favorite moment. It's painful, but they're generally right. It happened to me on the movie Without a Clue, the 1980s movie in which I played Sherlock Holmes. When I saw the edited version of the sword fight at the end of the movie, I said to the editor, you cut the funniest moment in the entire film. The slow reaction I did at the end. I know exactly the look you're talking about, said the editor. It would have been very funny. But the reaction took 5 seconds, and at this point in the movie we need pace. Look, this is what it would look like with your reaction in there. He fiddled about for a moment, then ran it back for me, and I saw he was right. Careers are made and broken by editors, and funny moments are killed, but you can be sure that they'll be doing what is best for the film as a whole. In a movie, and by the way, it's a completely different story in the theatre, which emphasizes how important it is to understand the industry you're in and the precise way it works. The people whose performances I'm least concerned about are those of other actors. At least I try not to be concerned. I have to admit that the one thing that can steal my focus on set is terrible acting. It fascinates me and distracts me, but it isn't my concern. If another actor isn't giving me what I want, I try to act as though he is. I try to put in my own best possible performance and act and react as if I'm getting the ideal performance back. I try to trust that the director has a plan and will make it right. Perhaps the other actor will end up on the cutting room floor. Critiquing my colleagues or interfering with their performances does not count as teamwork. That is, unless they're deliberately trying to undermine my performance or the movie itself. There are attention seekers, limelight hoggers, deceivers and bullies in every office and every family, and the film set is certainly no exception. Generally, the director will pick up on this and deal with it himself. If he doesn't, I find a long stare before I say my next line. Generally does the trick. The flip side of trying to ignore bad acting is trying not to get concerned about whether the other fellow in the scene is out-acting me. It should never be about trying to make myself appear better than the other guy, because everything must be done for the good of the whole. That's why I'm not one of those actors who eases up on my performance when I'm off camera, feeding lines for someone else's close-up. Maybe I'm not the one in the spotlight, but I still have a contribution to make so that the scene is the best it can be. Whether I'm on camera or off camera, whether it's my close-up or I'm just feeding lines, I play my role at the same pitch and with the same energy. A real team player understands that part of their contribution is doing whatever it takes to ensure everyone is giving their best. And of course a generous double act can be greater than the sum of its parts. I discovered that when I played Peachy opposite Sean Connery as Danny in The Man Who Would Be King, we each understood that for the sake of the picture, we had to bring each other into our close-ups rather than edging each other out. In long dialogue scenes, Sean would turn me full face to the camera for my important line, and I would return the compliment. Sean is one of the most unselfish actors I've ever worked with, and we developed a deep mutual trust and admiration. We were always thinking of each other, and the film was all the better for it. However full of stars a team is, a movie team, a football team, if those stars are too full of their own importance to work as a team, they're going to get beaten by a weaker side that has learned to work together. Only compete with yourself. Montgomery Clift used to say that the highest tribute you could pay another actor was to envy his performance. He thought it was healthy for one actor to look at another actor and think, I wish that had been me. I disagree. This kind of competitive comparison is rarely even possible, and when it is pointless and unhelpful. I love to go to the theatre and the movies, and I love watching TV. I absolutely love other actors, their skills and performances. I admire them and get great pleasure out of watching what they do. But I have no sense of competition with other actors. My predecessors, my contemporaries, or my successors. I love Humphrey Bogart. I love Marlon Brando. They are my heroes, my idols. But I'd never put myself up against them, and it's of no interest to me whether I'm as good as them or not. There's just no point in doing that. No possible advantage. I'm as good as I am, which is the best that I can do. My competition is always with myself. From my very first step on stage as a robot for Clubland, to my latest movie role, all I ever do is try to be the best I can possibly be, without reference to being better than anyone else. How can I find a role that stretches me further? How can I make this role better than the last role? How can I make this film better than the last film? How can I make this take better than the last take? What makes my heart sing is not besting another actor, but besting myself. The roles of which I am the proudest are the ones that have asked the most of me, that have been the furthest away from me, but that I feel I have made the most real. The parts where I feel I have truly managed to make myself disappear and summon up someone else. Frank, the disillusioned alcoholic university professor in Educating Rita. Dr. Larch, the rule-stretching gynecologist addicted to ether in the Cider House Rules. Thomas Fowler, the foreign correspondent in The Quiet American. Alfred Pennyworth, the wise and patient butler who knows how to handle himself in Chris Nolan's Batman movies. Ray Say, the seedy, angry and desperate agent in Little Voice. Harry Brown, the pensioner who loses his rag and goes on rampage in Harry Brown. Fred Ballinger, the faded, retiring composer. Youth. And of course, Alfie. The only time it is useful for me to decide how talented another actor is when I'm considering working with him or when I'm already working with him and trying to learn from him, because I only want to work with the best, and I only want to learn from the best. Other than that, it's of no interest. I tell my grandchildren the same thing. There'll always be someone faster than you, cleverer than you, better looking than you, richer than you, luckier than you. So forget competing with other people. It will just make you bitter, self-pitying, unhappy. Do your own thing and do it as well as you possibly can. When I was young, I read something urging Olympic athletes to chase the dream, not the competition. That line has stayed with me all my professional life. It is sound advice. Part 3, The Long Run, Chapter 11. Being a Star, or Why I Never Wear Suede Shoes. Betting to the top, to where you wanted to be, is a bit like climbing up a steep mountain path, reaching the peak, then taking in the view. It's bloody fantastic. Perhaps it's even better than you'd been anticipating. But it can also be a bit disorienting. Alongside the overwhelming feeling of achievement and elation, there is sometimes another feeling peering down over the edge of slight nausea. Standing at the summit does not always feel quite how you expected it would when you were looking at it from halfway up. So what can you expect if you become a star in movies or any other universe?